All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back. It is Tuesday afternoon, 12:40, here for Chem 12, and we're going to be doing NMR today. I'm still struggling with a little bit of computer issues here. Since I put the standing desk all together and re-put everything back together, things are not exactly working the way that they should be. So if we experience any difficulties, hang on and I will try to sort them out. I restarted my computer. I've rebooted everything. I've rechecked all my connections. We should be good. We'll see how this holds together. Okay, let me start a screen share. And that should work. All right, I can see all of you now. I can see the screen share. Last thing I'm going to get up is a chat, so I can see that. As I anticipate questions in the material that we're going to cover. Okay. Good to go. All right, what we're doing today, the plan for today is to start NMR. So we finished the exam that was on all that first material. And like I said, there is a dividing line here between these two different types of material that we do. We do all of the SN1, SN2, E1, E2. We get through the alkenes, the alkynes, the alcohols, the synthesis component. We get through all of that. And then we do a break and we move into spectroscopy. At least that's the way our textbook is set up. And it's a pretty good break right here between the different types of chemistry. And it's about time that we do spectroscopy. Spectroscopy in some textbooks, one of my favorite textbooks, includes it all the way through. In every chapter, every functional group you deal with, there's a little spectroscopy section. But throwing it all into one chapter also makes great sense. And it's a topic that we really haven't discussed much. You know, how do we know what all these molecules look like? And that's a great topic of discussion. And we're going to go through the different major types of spectroscopy. There's many, many more than what we're going to cover. We're going to cover nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. We're going to cover mass spectrometry. And we're going to cover IR. Although we won't do IR as much, we'll see how much you guys did IR from last semester. And I'll cover as much as I need to get everybody up to speed. But IR is sort of the last thing that we wind up going through. And we spend most of our time in NMR because that's the most difficult of the spectroscopies. Okay, so let's start off with that. Everybody can see the screen and screen sharing's going all right. Okay, cool. So we're gonna start off. Spectroscopy is a catch-all phrase. It used to mean spectrum, sort of as the visible spectrum or the electromagnetic spectrum of light, but spectroscopy has taken on a greater meaning to mean many different types of spectroscopy. And specifically, what we're going to look at is NMR. NMR is nuclear magnetic resonance. And there are many different types of NMR. We can do NMR with many different types of nucleuses. And essentially, all it really is that we take a look at the nucleus of an atom. And that nucleus of the atom, we can imagine that there are many different atoms that are floating around, and each one of them has a nuclear spin. And the spins are oriented in all different directions. And so this is the spin of the nucleus. And the spin is not really the way that it's rotating. The spin is more of a quantum mechanical spin. It's a property of the nucleus that generally, just like we think of electrons, and electrons have spin, and electrons have two spin states, they can either be spin up or spin down. Well, the nucleus has a spin state for the nucleus as well. And that spin state is a quantum mechanical feature of the nucleus as a whole, which contains, you know, which contains the protons and the neutrons. Okay, what we do is we take that and we place it into a magnetic field. So B, the symbol B, equals magnetic field. And usually we give that an orientation to the field. And then what happens is the nuclei align themselves with the field. So this takes all the nuclei and lines them up with the magnetic field. Once they are aligned with the magnetic field, then what we do is we send in an electromagnetic pulse. We send in a radio frequency, essentially. The radio frequency is absorbed by the nucleus, and it causes the nucleus to tip and to precess. And when we assigned these, or when we put all these nucleuses into this magnetic field, not only did they align, but something else happened when they aligned with the field. And that is that while there was only one energy for a nucleus previously, let's say that we had a nucleus that was sort of aligned in any orientation, when we added a magnetic field to it and it aligned with the magnetic field, it created two possibilities. It created a low energy possibility where the nucleus can be aligned with the field, and it created a high energy possibility where the nucleus can be aligned opposite the field. Or at least this is an easy representation. It's not really true. It's a simplification of how we look at it. But this can be considered to be an excited state. And a ground state. And the difference between these states is a difference in energy, which is equal to radio frequency, radio waves. And so just like we can input energy into an electron, and we can kick an electron up into an excited state orbital, we can put energy into the nucleus, and we can kick the nucleus into an excited state for the nucleus, which is a spin state, which is just opposite the magnetic field that it's placed into. And then that nucleus can relax. And as it relaxes, we'll give off energy equal to the distance between the ground state and the excited state.
Jason, I have a couple questions really quick. Sure. So when you said that you align the nuclei with a magnetic field, so then what you said that then you like expose it to a radio wave, that causes them, did you say to tilt?
Process to tilt. Yeah.
So okay. And then so do they measure the angle that it tilts at or something?
No. What we do is we simply listen to it as it relaxes and the energy that comes back out. And we're measuring the energy difference, just like we do. So imagine this experiment, right? So when we take a discharge tube, and the discharge tube has electrodes that are in the discharge tube. We have wires that go through here, and one of these is plus and one of these is minus. And then we power this thing, and we plug this thing into an instrument, plug it into the wall, and we pass energy through it, and light comes out of it. And that light that comes out of it, if we pass that light through a prism, then the light gets split up into different wavelengths, and I can see different wavelengths, right? And so these wavelengths, I make it different colors that are coming out of these wavelengths. The colors that I see may start off in the purple sort of range over here, and I make it something that's in the green range, something that's in the red range. I get close to ultraviolet. And so what I get is electromagnetic spectrum that comes out of this, where the wavelength here whatever this wavelength is of light that is coming out of this thing, that is proportional to the energy difference in the orbitals, where this is the ground state orbital and the excited state orbital. And so what basically happens is we start off in the ground state. Energy is kicked into this. It promotes the electron. The electron goes up to the excited state. The electron then transitions from the excited state back down to the ground state. So we can say that we had the electron that was here, it falls back down. And as it falls down, energy is released. That energy that is released, that photon, is equal to the change in energy that is the gap by which the electron fell. Right? Everybody's on the same page. So this is what happens with electrons. And this is our excitation spectrum for electrons. The nucleus does the same thing, except the nucleus doesn't change in its location. What happens is when we excite a nucleus and we put energy into the nucleus, the first thing is that we put that nucleus, which is oriented randomly, we put it into a magnetic field. The magnetic field then orients it and splits the energy levels. And what I like to do is I like to be a little bit more honest in what's happening. As the energy comes into this, and that energy is a radio frequency, radio wave, it causes a tilt, kicks it up into the higher energy state. And that tilt, let me see if I can, I'll draw it a little bit bigger. It precesses in a circle, essentially, which is higher energy than if the thing is in line with the magnetic field. And so this difference in energy here, what happens is the precession slowly dissipates and it falls back down into the ground state. And as it falls back down into the ground state, it releases a radio wave. So as this thing kicks back down, it releases energy, which is equal to the change in energy difference between the excited state and the ground state. And so it doesn't really flip the spin state. So the spin state isn't entirely opposite. It just kicks the spin state off kilter, allowing that spin state to precess, which is higher energy. And as that spin state slowly relaxes and comes back to normal, it gives off energy equal to the difference in energy between the two spin states. And that's what we listen for. And that's what we register. So we don't really register the tilt. We're not measuring how far it's tilting. We're just measuring the difference in energy between the ground state and the excited state as it comes off the instrument. And so this is nothing more than a radio experiment.
I'm kind of confused just because at the higher energy state where the alignment of the nuclei, that's when it opposes the field, right?
Well, it's not so much opposing it as much as it is, you know, if we have a field which is aligned this direction and this is our magnetic field, then as this thing is precessing, it is generating energy. It's higher in energy because it's not just simply aligned with the field itself.
Okay, so I guess why I'm confused is because in physics, I learned that like that higher energy state is transient. So is then the purpose, I guess, of the waves is to make that state occur more of the time. So, because if it occurs more of the time, you're going to have more, because like it in physics, we learned that it just doesn't really like occur a lot of the time. Like that's a pretty rare state to be in because it's, you know, like not perfectly in line with the field. So is the purpose of the radio waves to make there be a larger number of particles with that energy so you can measure more of them that are falling back to ground state?
Well, the reality of the situation is that at room temperature, the the spin states are very close to 50-50. So that while you say that in physics you learn that it's transient and not very frequent, it's actually not entirely true that the spin state is such that the energy difference between these is so small that at any one given time at room temperature, when you measure the populations in the two spin states, you've got about 50% that are in the excited spin state and about 50% that are in the ground state. When you pulse it and you hit it with energy, you take the 50% that are in the ground state and you kick them into the excited state, and then 50% of them are going to relax. And so you don't get a real strong signal out of this, but your goal here is to kick them all up into the excited state and then to give it time to go back to equilibrium. And in the time that it goes back to equilibrium, it gives off energy, and that energy is equal to the difference in energy between the two spin states.
Awesome. Now I get it.
So that's what you're trying to do.
Cool.
Okay. So that's basically the design of the entire experiment. That's all the experiment is. And essentially, an NMR, a nuclear magnetic resonance machine, when you look at it, it is an instrument that essentially has an opening at the top, a big fancy Dewar container, essentially. And inside this, there is a tube that comes down into the instrument. There's generally a two-stage sort of container inside here. So most large instruments in this piece here is filled with liquid nitrogen. And this piece here with liquid helium. And so, and then inside of this, they have magnets that are on either side. So in this part, there are magnets that are superconducting magnets. Those superconducting magnets need to be cryogenically cooled in order to maintain their superconducting ability. And then outside of that, there is a transmitter and a receiver. And these guys are sort of linked together down here through some control thing, some box that controls the whole thing. And there's a transmitter and receiver. And that's all an NMR is a giant Dewar to hold cryogenic cooling fluids to keep the magnet superconducting. And then it's nothing more than a radio transmitter and a radio receiver that deals with the sample. And that is an NMR instrument. And so most people get upset when they think about NMR and they hear the word nuclear. They think that nuclear means that we're doing some nuclear experiment. And we are. We're doing a nuclear experiment because we're working on the nucleus. But in that nuclear experiment, there is no radiation. There is no ionizing radiation that is released in the way that we think of nuclear bombs or nuclear fallout or nuclear, any sort of nuclear reactions. None of that's happening. What's happening here is all we're simply doing is exciting it with radio frequency and listening to the radio waves, listening to the music that these nuclei then give off. And that's the entire thing. And so there's nothing safer than NMR. The only thing that NMR is dangerous for is if you happen to have a pacemaker or some other sort of implanted device, and the magnetic, the magnets on these NMRs are so strong that they will wipe your credit cards off your wallet if you get too close with your wallet. That when you walk into an NMR room, you generally take your watch off, you generally take your wallet out of your pocket, you leave those by the door, and then you do your NMR experiment, and the computers have shrouding around the computers to protect the computers from the strong magnetic magnetic waves that come out of the thing. And other than that, there's nothing dangerous about doing an NMR experiment. So NMR only works for certain nuclei. The nuclei must have an odd spin. So it only works on odd spin nuclei, nuclei that are a half, three quarters, so on. It does not work on anything that is an even spin, such as one. So the nuclei, this is what we call the I value, is the spin state of the nucleus. And what we find is that different nuclei have different spin states. So when we look at hydrogen one, and we look at its I value, the I value of hydrogen is a half. Deuterium, the second isotope of hydrogen, has a spin state of one. Carbon 12 has a spin state of one. Carbon 13 has a spin state of a half. Nitrogen 14 and nitrogen 15, when we look at their I values, nitrogen 14 is one, nitrogen 15 is a half. And so what we see is that these guys here are NMR active. And you can do NMR with these nuclei, where you cannot do NMR with the nuclei that have a spin state of one, that have an even spin state. So you're limited to the certain types of nuclei that you can look at in the NMR. And you're also limited in your probe, that the probe has to be able to generate the right frequency to excite that nucleus. And so for certain instruments can do proton and can do carbon for very simple instruments. Other multi-nuclei instruments have tunable electronics where you can tune them to be able to do nitrogen or phosphorus or sodium or boron. There's many other half spin states which are interesting to do, but the main ones that we look at, the main two, are carbon and proton. Okay, but look at the isotopes that we're doing. We're doing the isotope, which is hydrogen, isotope one, but for carbon, we're doing carbon 13, not carbon 12. Right? And so when we look at the percent of nuclei, the reason that I wanted to kind of put this table out here is because I think the relative isotopic abundance on hydrogen is 99. Let me grab a periodic table and get the relative isotopic abundance for a second, because I don't have it at hand. Proton. It's 99.9850% of all hydrogen are hydrogen one. And for the proton, for deuterium, it's 0.0150. For carbon 12, it's 98.900. For carbon 13, it's 1.1%. And for nitrogen, it's for 14, it's 99.634. And for nitrogen 15, it's 0.3660. Okay, so why am I bringing these up? Interestingly, because the strength of a magnetic signal, or the strength of an NMR signal, is proportional to the isotope that you're looking at, and that if you're looking at protons that are 99.98% of all of the types of hydrogens, you can get a pretty strong signal out of that because you're querying something that is the major isotope. But if you're looking at carbon, only 1.1% of the carbons are C13, and C12 is 98.9%. This means that it's much harder to do carbon NMR because you get a much smaller signal coming out. We only get 1.1% of the signal out of all of the carbons because we're looking at the carbon-13 isotope, and that's the only one that we can see by NMR. We can't see the carbon-12 isotope by NMR. So not only is it certain nuclei that are NMR active, but that nuclei, its relative abundance is important to understanding the NMR experiment as well and how that NMR experiment works. Okay, so I said that in this NMR experiment, that what we were looking at was the difference in energy between the spin states. And the difference in energy between ground state and excited state is very small. And proportional to the strength of the magnetic field. Such that if we take and we make a graph, and it doesn't have to be a very big graph that we're going to do here, I just want to give you an idea. And we look at energy. And we look at Gauss, which is a measure of the magnetic field that we're looking at. And we look at a magnet that is 14,000 approximately. We look at a magnet that is 47,000. And out here, let's do 85,000. These go up much higher these days. These are just numbers that I happen to have. And these are the difference between the excited state and the ground state. So these are all ground state and excited state. The difference here is about 60 megahertz. The difference at the 47,000 Gauss is a difference of about 200 megahertz. And at 85 Gauss, this is 300 megahertz or 360 megahertz. Now, hertz is cycles per second. And what we said is that we're reading the energy here of the radio waves that is the difference in energy. And so the way that we refer to an instrument is we generally don't refer to the instrument in its magnetic strength. We refer to the instrument by the difference in energy that it causes between the ground state and the excited state for the proton. Generally not the carbon, but for the proton. So this would be for proton NMR. And we usually list the isotope. So this is proton one NMR. And so we refer to a magnet as being a 60 megahertz magnet, a 200 megahertz magnet, a 360 megahertz magnet. Now, that's not to say that the magnet has that strength of Gauss. What that is to say is that the magnet is of a strength that causes a difference in energy between the excited state and the ground state on order of that many megahertz. And what we find is in this range, between 600, excuse me, between 60 and 90. In this range here, between 60 and 90, these are fixed magnets. So this is in the 60 to 90 range in terms of megahertz. As soon as you get above 90, these are all superconducting magnets. And the largest instruments that they have now are over a gigahertz, so that the instruments that we can utilize now have magnets that are much, much larger. I've never used a gigahertz instrument before. They're extremely expensive, millions and millions of dollars. Just to give you a sort of framework, these 60 to 90 hertz instruments will run in the range of anywhere from 50 to 60,000 to about 150,000 for a good 90 megahertz instrument. The difference between a fixed magnet and a superconducting, fixed magnets do not need supercoolant. They don't need the liquid nitrogen and the liquid helium. They can work at ambient room temperatures and they hold their fixed magnet strength. Superconducting magnets need to have that cryogenic cooling. They need to be charged and maintained, and they're extremely expensive. So about 90 megahertz runs about $125,000, $150,000 for that instrument. As soon as you start getting up into the 200, 360, now you're starting to talk in the $500,000 range, and up into millions of dollars. It goes up exponentially as you get up into the gigahertz range of NMR instruments. So they're extremely expensive. Oh, and why do we want the stronger difference here? Because as you create, and this goes right back to the question that we had earlier from Sterling, which was, there's not very much difference between the ground state and the excited state because the energy difference is so small. If you can create a bigger energy difference, you can create a bigger population difference. And then when you pulse it, more molecules, more nuclei will relax, giving you a stronger signal out, which means that you have to do less acquisitions in order to get good signal to noise ratio. And your experiment takes much, much less time and you get much better resolution on your experiment. So the bigger the energy gap we can create, the better the experiment works. That's the whole idea behind going for bigger and bigger magnets, is it makes the experiment work that much better. Yeah, so that's why. Go ahead.
Does our school have one of these? Do we have an NMR machine at Cabrillo?
At Cabrillo, it has been my goal for 20 years to get a hold of an NMR machine, and I have not done it yet. So the thing about the NMR, like I was saying, is that the superconducting magnets, it takes a staff person to understand how to operate and to maintain that instrument. And you have to do weekly additions of the liquid nitrogen and the liquid helium. And somebody has to maintain that thing over all the holidays, over Christmas, over the vacations, everything. And it's just it's a big maintenance thing. To have a 90 megahertz magnet that's a fixed magnet was about $125,000, $150,000 for that instrument. And that's been my goal, is to get one of those fixed magnet ones. It would have limited use, but it would still be good in the lab. We could still learn how to use the NMR and work with it and use the software and analyze our products that come out of the lab. It just doesn't have the resolution that, say, a 350 would have, or a nice 250 instrument. But that's why I haven't done it yet. It's just the expense. It's just more than what the college is willing to bear right now. Okay, so that's the design of the experiment. And essentially what we do in an NMR experiment is we take the sample, usually a couple of milligrams, maybe like 5 milligrams at most. You put it into an NMR tube. The NMR tube is a very small, long, cylindrical tube. It's a little bit bigger than a capillary tube. You put about 3 fingers worth of material into here with solvent. And a few milligrams. You take that and you put it into the NMR instrument. When it goes into the NMR instrument, it is loaded into the instrument with a collar that goes over this. The collar sits up here. And there's a puff of air that you turn on in the instrument. That puff of air, when the collar goes in, it blows on the collar and supports the tube so that it floats on that cushion of air. It slowly reduces the cushion of air and allows this to drop down into the instrument. When it drops down into the instrument, there are also spines on this thing that air blows past it this way and spins it. So the whole sample is spun inside the instrument in order to make it homogeneous. Then we take the magnets that are in here, and the magnets can be moved in different orientations until the magnetic field is homogeneous. And this part is called shimming. The goal is to get a homogeneous magnetic field. Every sample that you put into the instrument has a slightly different volume, slightly different optical density, slightly different viscosity. And so every single time you reload a new sample into the instrument, you need to go through the shimming all over again. And the shimming is just a matter of playing with the magnetics, the magnets in these different orientations, and you slightly move it in the XYZ plane until, and you watch a screen, and there's a screen that gives you a readout that tells you what the magnetic field is doing, and you get the magnetic field as homogeneous as possible. Once that's done, then we go through sample acquisition. We pulse and relax. Let's say pulse and read. So basically what we do is we send in a sequence that looks like this. So this is excitation, where we're pulsing it with a radio frequency. And this is your relaxation and read. This is where we're listening at the bottom of the wells. And we repeat that over and over and over again. For proton, you may, depending on the magnet, you may do 10, 20, 30 acquisitions. For a carbon, depending upon the strength of the field, you may be doing thousands of these acquisitions, because remember that carbon is so much smaller because we're looking at the C13 nucleus. What comes out when we listen is what's called a FID. So the output is a free induction decay. And that free induction decay is a pulse sequence that oftentimes has a very nice repeating pattern that keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And we call this FID, we call this the FID. It's the free induction decay signal that is the wave pattern that comes off the experiment as the nuclei relax. And so this FID, what we're seeing here, that piece fits in right here. This is where the FID comes in. And so it's not like this is a pulse and then it's not like it's a pulse, read, pulse, read, pulse, read. No, this is the entire read. And what we're doing is we're reading that, and we stack each one of these reads on top of each other to get a bigger signal to noise ratio so that we accumulate all those different read cycles. Then this goes through a mathematical operation that is a Fourier transform. And it deconvolutes the FID into a line spectrum. The line spectrum then gives us individual lines that we put on a scale that we call parts per million, and or sometimes this is in hertz. So we can read it in hertz or we can read it in parts per million, and I'll show you how the parts per million is calculated. This has a symbol that we call lowercase delta. Delta stands for difference. And so this little lowercase delta stands for, in this case, we call it the chemical shift. And that chemical shift is represented in either units of parts per million or in hertz. And what we have is we have directions. This is called downfield. And this direction is called upfield. And it usually runs from zero on up to some max number that depends on the nuclei. So the number up here that it runs to depends on nuclei observed. For proton NMR, that number runs from about 14 on down to zero parts per million. For carbon 13, the scale runs from about 220 on down to zero. So the proton NMR has a much bigger, the carbon NMR has a much bigger chemical range than the proton does. All right, so what is this chemical shift and why do we call it a chemical shift? Because chemical shift has a formula. This is equal to the frequency of the sample minus the frequency of a reference divided by the frequency applied. And then we multiply it by 10 to the sixth to put it into parts per million, which seems like an odd, you know, we've talked about parts per million in terms of Chem 1A and Chem 1B before. When you were in Chem 1B, you probably used parts per million. And a part per million was simply one part out of however many parts the whole is. And then you multiply it by a million. And that's where your parts per million come from. It's just a percentage. It's nothing more than if we were to say percent, percent is one part in 100. And part per million is one part in a million. What we're doing here is that generally this change is so small compared to the applied field that we're generally looking at parts per million in terms of the change over the applied field. And that's why we multiply it by 10 to the sixth. Just to give you an example, let's say that we were looking at a 500 megahertz. Maybe I had it at 50 megahertz. Okay, 50 megahertz C13 and the signal at 1040 hertz downfield. We never have to do this. I just want to give you just an idea. So we've got 50 megahertz C13 and a signal that is 1040 hertz downfield. The chemical shift would be 1040, subtract our reference point, which we're going to call zero, divided by 50 times 10 to the sixth, because it's megahertz. So this piece here is how I'm getting to megahertz. And then we multiply this by 10 to the sixth. And we're doing that in order to put it into parts per million. These guys cancel each other out. And this is just 20.8 parts per million. And so what we would see is on the zero to 220, we would get a signal out here at 20.8. And that would be on the parts per million scale. And that's how it would represent. What is the frequency applied? JC, the frequency applied is the frequency at which we are pulsing the nuclei. That's the excitation frequency.
So when you get that signal at 20.8 parts per million, what does that mean? I mean, it means obviously that there's carbon 13 in the sample, right? But like, what, how are you going to use that information?
Great question. Okay. So what it turns out is that this is a story that I like to tell because chemists and physicists like to poke fun at each other. So the story goes that the physicists figured out that we could do this. And when they did this, they shined the electromagnetic radiation on it and they got signals that came out all over the place. And so it wasn't very useful in being able to tell where the carbon was or what type of carbon was. And chemists took a look at that and said, oh no, that's very useful because now we could tell every little micro environment that the carbon is in and we can sort it all out. And so that whole story is that I'm sure it was physicists who figured this out, not chemists, but it was physical chemists that realized that electron withdrawing groups and electron donating groups on the molecule cause differences in the shielding and deshielding of nuclei, which cause some to be a higher PPM than others. And so it's all about little micro differences within the molecule of electron withdrawing and electron donating that tell us about the chemical environment in which a nucleus sits. And we can tell that based on its PPM. We can tell what environment it's sitting on just based on what that number is that the PPM is there. So it tells us about all the different types of carbon that are in a molecule. So that's the next thing. Let me show you. Looking to see where I have it, and I don't have it here, so I have to make it up. Okay. What is it about parts per million and what is downfield and upfield? And this point is zero. Let's talk about the reference first of all, and then from the reference, sometimes it's a little bit easier to explain. So a reference material, the reference point. What we want to do is use a material for the reference point, which has, I'll do these in tandem, okay. I'm formulating a plan on how I want to explain this. When you look at the nucleus, and we look at the difference in spin states between something that is precessing in its excited state, something that is in its ground state, the nucleus also has an electron cloud around it. And when we look at the magnetic field, the electron cloud that is around the nucleus effectively shields the nucleus from the magnetic field. It opposes the magnetic field, and generally what it does is subtracts from the magnetic field such that it's almost like a spaceship that has shields on the spaceship, right? And so that when you like fire lasers at the spaceship, the shields protect the spaceship. If we're going with the Star Wars, Star Trek analogy here, you tell what I've been watching, The Mandalorian. The electron cloud does much the same thing. What the electron cloud does is the electron cloud opposes the magnetic field and reduces the magnetic field such that what happens is we get a reduced B effective. This is the effective magnetic field. The effective magnetic field is the full magnetic field subtract the electron magnetic field which is opposing it, and we get B effective, which reduces down the distance between the excited state and the ground state. Okay, now what happens if I take away that electron density? If I remove some electron density, then what happens is if we remove outer electron density, this was our situation that we originally had. And this was our difference in energy. And we have that electron cloud that is around it. Remove the electrons. And as we remove the electrons, then the B effective, which before was subtracting the electron cloud from it, now B effective becomes larger. And as B effective becomes larger, the difference in energy between the excited state and the ground state becomes larger. And so what we say is that the electrons are still here. I just have a smaller amount of them. Well, what is it that removes electrons? What is it that can pull electron density?
Electron withdrawing groups.
Electron withdrawing groups. And so when you put an electron withdrawing group in a molecule, what it does is it deshields the nuclei. So this is what is called deshielding. And that's what we refer to it as. And it's done by electron withdrawing groups. So electron withdrawing groups deshield and pull electron density away from nuclei. And so what we see is that when we look at that scale, and we're out here and we're at parts per million, and now we can come back and we can do the zero point, what we find is that what is downfield, downfield also equals deshielding. And that what is upfield, upfield means shielded. And so to Sterling's question, it is the small micro shieldings and deshieldings within a molecule that tell us what its chemical environment is and where it is. And we can see that and we can understand that just by looking at the electron withdrawing groups within the molecule to a degree. I mean, then we also need some tables and lots of data and everything else. Okay, so the zero point, I was gonna say what the zero point is. What I want is something that is the most shielded that I can. So what is the opposite of an electron withdrawing group that deshields? What would I say the opposite is? Electron donating group. All right. And what's the best electron donating group that we have? I don't think that you guys know, actually. Silicon. TMS. This is tetramethylsilane. And we call it TMS. Like the TMS group that we use as a protecting group, except this isn't a protecting group. This is a molecule that has its equivalent to tertiary butane. It just has a silicon in the center of it. And silicon is an electron donating group. Silicon, in terms of its polarity, is such that the silicon is partial positive and the carbon is partial minus. And so the silicon is an electron donating group and sets up what we use as a reference point. And this is what we call zero parts per million, is we look at both the carbon and the hydrogen on the TMS, and we say that those are our points of reference and zero parts per million. Now, are there things that are more electron donating than silicon? Yes. Are there things that can come at negative parts per million? Yes, but very, very few. And so this is what we tend to use as our reference point. And it was practice that when you did NMR, that you would actually take a small amount of TMS and put it into your sample and put it into the NMR so that you would get the zero mark on the NMR, and then everything else would be gauged next to that. And we would actually go into the computer and tell it that point right there, that is zero. And then it would set up everything else. We don't do that anymore. Usually what we do is the instrument now, the electronics and the computers are sophisticated enough to be able to know the calibrated zero point. But if we want to recalibrate the instrument, then we would put in a sample of TMS and recalibrate the instrument and tell it where the zero point is again. And that's how we would go through and do that. So everything comes downfield from TMS that we're going to be looking at. And essentially then what we start to learn is we start to be able to look at a molecule and to understand what that molecule is going to look like, both in carbon and proton. So let's take a simple molecule. Let's take a molecule that is 1,2-chloroethane. Dichloroethane. And what we want to do is we want to look at its proton spectrum and its carbon spectrum. Okay, this out here always starts at zero. This is going to run up to 14, and this one's going to run up to 220. And these are on the parts per million scale. When we look at this, the chlorine pulls on the carbon and also pulls on the hydrogen. So what we see here is that when we look at the two hydrogens, actually technically the four, that all four of these hydrogens are what are called in the same chemical environment. In other words, these two hydrogens are attached to a carbon that is next to a chlorine and attached to a C that has two hydrogens and chlorine on it. And these two hydrogens are on a carbon attached to a chlorine and next to a carbon with two hydrogens and a chlorine on it. And so these guys are all in the same chemical environment. These two chlorines are electron withdrawing groups, which de-shield the hydrogens, and they create a signal which is at 3.75 parts per million. And so we get a line that is out here at 3.75. And for the carbon, what we see is these two carbons are in the exact same chemical environment, and they show up at 44. And those are the carbon signals. And so what we typically do is when you look in an NMR book that is a really sort of good NMR book, what you will see is you will see the molecule written out, and they'll use color oftentimes to do 3.75. And then in black, they will do 44. That gives you both the proton signals on the molecule and the carbon signals on the molecule as a way of sort of noting where they're showing up. And we're only getting one type of hydrogen and one type of carbon. Oh, there's another little signal. There's another little signal right here. It's a little triplet, shows up at 78. That we need to talk about for a second. And there was a question, so I want to catch the question before I go on, because I'm going to move on to something a little bit different.
No, I was just wondering what the scale was because I couldn't see it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so that little 78. When we take and put the sample into the NMR tube, we use a solvent. But the question is, you know, we use like a few milligrams of sample plus like maybe 1.5 milliliters of solvent to get us up to like this three fingers height that I call it. How come the solvent doesn't show up in the protons and doesn't show up in the carbon NMR? The answer is the solvent does show up in the carbon NMR, but it doesn't show up in the proton NMR. Why? Well, because usually what we use is an NMR solvent. The most common being CdCl3. What element is D?
Deuterium.
Yeah. Deuterium is, you know, when we talk about H1, this is the proton. This is what we call hydrogen. But H2, this is deuterium. And the spin states, I equals a half for the proton, but I equals one for deuterium. Deuterium is not NMR active. Deuterium doesn't show up in the NMR. It's invisible to the NMR. And so when we use a deuterated solvent like this, we use a solvent which our compound is soluble in, but is a deuterated solvent. So these are deuterated NMR solvents. And CdCl3 is the most common, but there is all sorts of ones. There is CD3OD, deuterated methanol. There is deuterated acetone. There is deuterated DMSO. There is every sort of solvent that you would use as a regular solvent within organic chemistry. There's a deuterated solvent for NMR, which is kind of cool. So the deuterium doesn't show up in the sample. So we don't see any additional protons in the proton spectrum. But what we do see right here, this is CdCl3. This is solvent. And we learn to recognize where that solvent is. And that solvent is coming from the carbon of the CdCl3. And those chlorines, and it's actually the deuterium, I think, causes the carbon to be split into a little triplet signal. We'll talk about splitting in a little while later, but that little 78 is from the CdCl3. That's the NMR solvent that we're using. Okay, so we've covered solvents. Let's look at another molecule. Let's look at just two chlorines. So this is now 1,1 dichloroethane. So in 1,1 dichloroethane, again, we can look at the proton. And we can look at the carbon. And what we find is that there are now two different types of hydrogens on this molecule. So there is a hydrogen which sits here. This is HA. And then there's each of these types of hydrogen, where these are HBs. So HA, and then my three HBs. Okay, and HA is next to the electron withdrawing groups, which means that HA is going to be deshielded more than HB. Does that make sense? HA is going to be more deshielded than HB, which means that I should find HA farther downfield. So here's my parts per million, my zero. And what I find is that I get a signal at 590. And I get a signal at 207. This goes up to about 14. And on the carbon NMR, I get a signal at 31. And a signal at 69. And that little triplet at 78. And then this goes up to 220. Okay, so what's going on? Go ahead, question.
So is the height of the line proportional to the amount present in that environment?
You are just like clockwork with the questions that are just perfectly on cue. I need to like pay you or something for this. Yes, the height of these is, it's actually not the height per se. That's what I wanted to sort of get into, is that these are not lines as much as they are actual peaks. And the area under the peak is proportional to the number of protons that are giving rise to it. So essentially, it is the integration of the area under the peak that is proportional to the number of protons giving rise to the signal. So the area under the peak is proportional to the number of protons giving rise to the signal. So it's integration. And usually what we do is we use a symbol to integrate with. Let me pick something that's going to stand out well. I'll use green. What they do is they use an integration symbol. That gives me bars. That now I can measure the height, which is this height is proportional to the integration. And so these little integration bars are what we call them. The integration bars allow me to then just measure heights, taking the integrations into account for me, and they will give me the values of these integration bars. And it would be a ratio of 3 to 1. That works for proton. It does not work for carbon. So carbon is not proportional. You can't integrate carbon in the same way that you can integrate hydrogen. So the question is, well, I could either just tell you that and have you accept it, or I could explain to you why that's really true. And Sterling's just gonna ask me anyway, so I might as well just go for it. The reason that carbon cannot be integrated in the same way that proton does is that proton relaxes very fast. So what happens is, in the normal population of things, between the excited state and the ground state, we normally have, so this is for HNMR, usually have a population that is in the excited state that is approximately 50% and 50%. You pulse it, you excite it, and then in your excitation, you kick sort of 100% of them up into the excited state, and you've got zero in the ground state. And then these fall down very quickly within the pulse sequence. And it goes back to normal within the pulse sequence, within this time it is here, it returns to normal. And so this is fast, that it goes back to being 50% and 50%. So that time is very fast. For carbon NMR, it's not so fast. For carbon NMR, what happens is you pulse this thing when you excite it, you do kick it up into 100%, but then the relaxation of carbon is for some of them fast and for some of them very slow. And so what happens is the slow ones get stuck in the excited state and the slow ones show up less and less and less. They get smaller and smaller signals. So what happens in carbon NMR is this. For different types of carbon, we've got tertiary, we've got, quaternary, tertiary, secondary, and then primary. I don't know what I want to use for primary. I'll use purple. So this is quaternary, tertiary, secondary, primary. Relaxation rates differ depending upon the degree of saturation. Primary is much faster than secondary, which is much faster than tertiary, which is much faster than quaternary. And these guys are so slow they're extremely slow to relax, such that what happens is they frequently get stuck in the excited state and they never even show up. And so you can have signals for something that is primary, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, where sometimes these get lost. And these would be for equal numbers. So let's say that I had 10 that were primary, 10 that were secondary, 10 that were tertiary, and 10 that were quaternary. I would get a pattern where they decrease in intensity because of their relaxation time, not because of their relative abundance. Am I making that clear? And so carbon NMR can't be integrated. We can't integrate carbon NMR because the relaxation times are just different. Now, you could integrate carbon NMR if you allowed for the slow relaxation time of a quaternary carbon and you set the relaxation time at the longest time possible so that everything could relax. But that would take your NMR experiment from, say, a half an hour to maybe taking a week. And it's not viable anymore. So that's why we don't do it. That's we just give up and we just don't integrate the carbon NMR. And we get other information. Other information is going to come from the carbon NMR. It turns out that we don't need those integration values anyway. So it's okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. I just was trying to think about like the electron shielding around, you know, like the primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. So around the quaternary and stuff, there's like more, the bonds are longer, right? Because they're between two carbons, right? So there's like a more drawn out region of electron density. Is that part of like why the quaternary ones have such a delayed response?
If I had to guess, I would guess that when a carbon is connected to a proton, that there is an exchange of energy between the proton and the carbon that allows for a dissipation of energy at a faster rate than when a carbon is surrounded by other heavy nuclei, such as carbons. That the transfer to the smaller nuclei happens faster and the dissipation happens faster. And so the more protons there are on the carbon, the faster the relaxation time. That's a guess. I don't have the backing of having read that to fully substantiate that.
But I'm going to quote you on it.
Yeah, I figured you're taking it right to Marcus. It's going right to physics. It's going to come back at me. That's cool. So yeah, I don't know the exact cause of that, but I don't think it's just about bond length. I think it's about harmonic oscillation and about the nuclei size and the dissipation of energy that can happen when you have hydrogens there as opposed to other heavy nuclei. So I think it's because we see it not only with carbons, we see it when the nuclei is attached, when carbon is attached to other heavy nuclei as well, such as nitrogen, oxygen, chlorine. All of those things can slow the relaxation time of the carbon down. And so if I have a carbon that has three chlorines on it and another carbon, it's going to act like a quaternary carbon and it might drop out. Its relaxation time might be really slow. So it's not just about the degree of saturation, because we wouldn't look at that carbon and say that carbon is quaternary with those three chlorines on it. But it acts that way because it doesn't have protons on it.
So if you have like a nitro group on a carbonyl compound,
yeah,
or on just on a carbon compound, you would use the adjacent hydrogens because you wouldn't be able to see the nitro group, but you would be able to see that the hydrogens are in a state where the nitrogen shields the nuclei in a certain way.
De-shields, yes.
De-shields, okay.
Yes, correct. So we start to use chemical shift to understand what the chemical environment is. And what we have done is we have tabulated in lots of books, big books, we have tabulated all of the different chemical environments that can occur and where they show up in the parts per million, such that we just look things up on tables to figure out what the neighbor of that proton is that's giving rise to that chemical shift. That's essentially what we wind up doing. All right, so there's two important skill sets. Number one is an understanding of chemical environment and which chemical environments produce what signal. That's one. The second thing is an understanding of the number of chemical environments that are given rise to by certain arrangements. So what do I mean? Let's look at two molecules. Structural isomers. Molecule A, molecule B. And let's give two spectrums. So we'll look at two proton spectrums. So this is HNMR. And what I get is I get a 29 and a 46. Ooh, I'm in carbon. Where's my proton? I didn't do proton for this one, damn it. Okay, swap it up, just change it to carbon. Do carbon NMR, this will work. So I got 29, 46, 46. And I got the little 78 that's in there hanging out. And then in a second spectrum, what I've got is 14, 17, 36. So I've got a 14, very close to that. I've got a 17, and then a little ways away from that, I got a 36. And then I got my little 78, which is hanging out there. And I want to correlate compound to spectrum. One of the ways in which I can do this, without knowing anything about NMR and where these signals show up at, is to take a look at the number of signals. What I can see is that in this first molecule, there are two different types of carbon. There's the carbon that the bromine is directly attached to, and then two other carbons that are chemically equivalent. This gives me two signals, or what we say is two chemical environments. And when I look at the other molecule, go away, calendar item. When I look at the other molecule, what I see is that I have the one that the bromine is attached to. I have a step away from the bromine, and then I have a step even farther away. And there are three signals. Those three signals equal three chemical environments. That allows me to be able to correlate the two structures with their respective spectrums. Because now I can say that the structure that has the bromine directly attached here, that's my 46. These guys here are my 29. Those are the two signals. And then on the other one, I've got this guy. Which is at 17. I've got color-wise, where did I go? I went green. Green is this one, which is at 36. And then the last one I did blue at 14. And that shows you where the signals are. And so what we're looking at is we're looking at here the number of environments. And similarly here. Is that making sense? And so figuring out the number of chemical environments in a structure allows you then to be able to help sort out what the structure is. And if you understand your electron withdrawing groups and which electron withdrawing groups are stronger and which ones are weaker, you can sort out the spectrum as well based on electron withdrawing groups. Now we're going to do more than that. We're going to use NMR tables, and we're going to get a good NMR table both for proton and carbon to help us do these different spectrum and analyze the spectrum and figure out what the spectrum is. But it's going to start from a better understanding of chemical environments. And so this morning's lab, what I did is I worked with this morning's lab looking at chemical environments. And I'd like to do the same with the afternoon's lab, because now we're 2:06, I'm a little over time. So I'm going to call it quits at this point, but we'll do chemical environments with the afternoon lab. And then when we come back on Thursday, then we're going to dig deeper into NMR. So NMR, I've just given you the surface of it. Gets much more complicated than this. There's something called spin-spin splitting that we need to look at and understand, and lots of intricacy and lots of practice that's going to be required in this. And so I'm going to give you guys some good resources too, but some really good places to go to get practice for the NMR, because the problems that are in the textbook are not adequate practice for what we need to do here. This is the one failing of the textbook that I feel, this is the one failing of any textbook, because there is no textbook that can give you enough NMR practice to be able to become proficient to the degree that you need to with NMR. So I'm going to give you some other resources to be able to find the practice that you need with answer keys and all that stuff. So we'll talk more about that as we go forward. So I'm going to turn you guys loose here. I'll let anybody stay on the line who wants to ask questions, and I'll stay on with you for a little bit, and then I'll see that afternoon lab at 3 o'clock. Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome, guys. All right, I'm going to stop the recording, and then I'll let questions fire away.
What you got, Sterling?